The recording has started. She's very happy.
Okay, Derek.
Her.
You wanted
it's
to
her.
Talk. Yes, yes. Derek, you wanted to talk about Brexit, so
yes.
You're going to lead.
Yes, I can. I've had several ideas about it. I've been obsessed with it because I think that as a European returning to Europe many times, or a regional European, I felt recognition and joy at crossing frontiers without having to do all kinds of silly things, except, of course, now with all the security that has been increased. One still sort of does, but at least from the point of view of administration, you could feel European simply crossing any boundary.
Mm.
And that was something new. It was a new emotion, a new ground emotion for me.
Yeah.
Ground emotions are the ones that interest me about Brexit.
Well, wait a minute. When did that start? 92? When did this borderless situation in Europe?
About the time Euro started. So, Euro started becoming the unitary monetary unit for all the countries except England and Switzerland. But Switzerland never belonged to the European community formally. It has trade agreements, but it is not one of the countries, Euro countries. But
so it was about 92. I remember something happened.
I would say around that time.
So 22 plus years.
You'd have to go and check that.
Right. So you've enjoyed this moving around your.
Oh yeah. Oh, for 20 years for sure.
So how is Brexit going to disrupt that?
Brexit is not going to necessarily disrupt that. Well, it does in some ways. First of all, it threatens other countries for sure. Because the example is there, and there have always been in every country people who did not agree simply because they were victim of it. And one can be victim economically of the European community because it has these rules, applies them indiscriminately in contexts that they don't study, and there are all kinds of stupid things that happen with Brexit, with the European community, and so a build-up of antinomy, for example, in the Netherlands, in the I don't know, there are two or three countries which are expressing the desire to get out. Italians are not very vocal so far on this matter, although Grillo and his group are kind of, saying, let's get out of it, let's go back to our miserable lira. Mm. But no, the question of the emotion of the unity that was supposed to grow and was growing, including sometimes countries that were not ready, such as Greece, this feeling of the growth of a common space without the traditional, rather, beyond the obstacle of language, you'd have all these administrative obstacles, and you would just feel, okay, well, these are Germans, and we are French, and we are Italian, or whatever. That's not the case. Under the European community, you are reminded every time that you are now part of this larger order, which includes all these interesting people.
Mm.
And that's the difference. Okay, so Brexit definitely has—it's a dint in my armor. I'm talking personally here, but I'm sure it's a dint in many people's armor. And a lot of Brits themselves are not happy with it at all because they don't feel it as a pleasant experience. Now, the ceiling business is fundamental for Brexit because that's what made it happen. People had feelings much more than they had reasonings. In fact, they didn't know Brexit. I mean, they didn't even know what it implied. They didn't know that it would touch the economy, that the pound would drop and all this. A lot of people didn't have a clue. They just voted, and that's what interests me. Why does one vote? Why does one and how does one take a decision? These are questions, very interesting questions. And so I was reading during my exploration of Brexit. My first post was actually rather elitist, and I don't want to take it back, but at the same time, I think I hadn't given enough thought to the whole scene. But what I was saying basically is that we were now all biased into a trend of mediocrity that I saw beginning, obviously, we could say beginning with Bush, but let's say that in Toronto it was Rob Ford, and from Rob Ford you moved on to Donald Trump, and from Donald Trump you had Brexit, like with those idiotic people, Farage and those cowards also. They really are cowards, these people, that did the whole scene. Who else was involved?
What did you just say? Did you say cowards?
Cowards, yeah. because they played for their own interest with a theme that might work in their favor, which of course it did. And the moment the stuff is done, they all give their, you know, I'm Boris Johnson, but I'm not going to take this mess and carry it forward. I'm Nigel Farage, but, you know, I'm getting out of this, though I'm going to get paid for another 2 years as a representative in the European Commission, because the guy, European Union, the guy actually has destroyed the relationship that he was supposed to represent, gets paid for it for the next 2 years, and he has taken himself off the, I mean, they're cowards. They're a bunch of cowards. So mediocrity runs supreme. Okay, it sounds elitist, and it is in some fashion, but of course we do need good people to run our countries. And these people are mediocre, and it's terrible. On the other hand, my point was that, you know, the age, but more than the age groups, the origins of the voters was a very key thing, so that all these country people who were like around Toronto voted for Ford, they would vote for Brexit, not knowing very much, not being terribly educated, and probably also being socioeconomically in the lower segments. Again, a judgment that... Then I read something which really fascinated me, was that when we make decisions, they are based on a whole set of, a whole set of unconscious drives and assumptions and sentiments and feelings, which really only when they are summoned may come up to consciousness, but by and large they are the ground from which we make our decision. Nothing new in there. Unconscious, subconscious, call it what you may, it may just be that. But here is a precision that an analysis has brought to this issue, which is very interesting, which is the time there is between the time your unconscious decision has found an order is preceding the time of the actual decision, the one that you're conscious of. This is the time I have now made that decision, or this is the moment I put down my hand to vote. In fact, all the organization of your unconscious and hence uncontrollable drivers within your own sensibility have something like almost half a second between the time you've made that decision and the time your brain has organized itself for that decision. One can dispute a lot about this finding. What I find interesting is the possibility that, in fact, a lot of our decisions have very little to do with our willpower and much more to do with simply the automatic self-organizing assembly of our prejudices, so to speak. So if you look at that and you see, you know, I'm a Brit, I'm a voter, what would be one of the drivers that certainly would influence the ordering of my brain before I had made my decision? It would be what I call mental geography. It would be the fact that you're an island, you know you're an island, everybody's reminded you you're an island. This island mental geography that you have is actually, proud or not, whatever sentiments accompany the feeling, but it's definitely an identity issue. This is who you are. You are part of this island. That would be ground. And that from that ground would surge an automated response. Automatically you would say, you know, if you didn't think about it, because, of course, they didn't think about it, then you would actually vote Brexit. Yeah. And that was a big surprise. I think people didn't recognize the possibility that some basic Englishness would actually drive these people, as opposed to any kind of rational, plus the fact that, of course, the Brexit people did not appeal to reason at all. They were fooling around with bus. A huge bus that ran around London and other place saying that they were, you know, Britain was paying 350 million euros or pounds a week to be part of the union. Of course, it was a lie, and in fact the balance between what came out of the union and what came out of Britain was entirely in favor of Britain. But that's again, I'm saying there is this question of appealing, of course, to the emotions rather than the reason, but more than anything else, the various, what would be interesting to know which one they were, but the various grounds from which the decision would suddenly mature. I was influenced in that thought because of a French novelist. We were talking about new novels and how they made you think differently yesterday, but or the day before. A French novelist called Nathalie Sarraute, she wrote books based on what she called sub-conversation, conversation under the conversation, in which she would analyze very fine-tuned analysis of how many and how many forms the feelings of people in discussion could actually be present, and that would eventually emerge into words. Fascinating, I mean, very attentive study, and I'm surprised that, in fact, psychologists haven't picked up on it, because it is an interesting way by which one can say, here is why I've said this. And these were the various things present in my mind, but not really, not so much in my mind, in my present, so to speak.
Yes.
These were the things that actually motivated what I said. And I find that interesting. I think that there's a man I met once who has written, who's writing about this, and I'm going to go back to his work, Brian Massumi.
Oh, yeah.
Brian Massumi, you know him?
Yeah, he translated Baudrillard and people like that.
That's right.
Yeah.
Massumi is a brain. He's a very nice man, too. He's got a beautiful wife, Erin, who's also a big intellectual.
Isn't he
but,
in Montreal?
No, he, I think,
or did he, huh? Isn't he in Montreal?
He's in Montreal, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He's very much in demand because he's one of the better thinkers, not only of Canada, but in this whole field.
Yes.
So anyway, that's one person.
What did he say?
Who,
why are you citing him?
I think I vaguely remember having read something by Massumi, which was decidedly in the line of what I'm just saying.
Yes.
How do words eventually emerge, and what precedes that emergence? And it's a very interesting question because it goes one level deeper than our standard avowed, recognized, confessed motivations.
Well, is this what Zingroni writes about in the media simplex, the preconscious?
Yeah, possibly. Not as I said, I haven't read the media simplex. I confess to the almighty Zingroni that it was escaped. I have it somewhere. But what happened was I was traveling too much, and then things that I put on the side eventually don't get picked up.
Right. You might want to see if he was emphasizing the preconscious. Maybe he's talking about what you're talking about.
Yeah, but you see, the point is that probably he would emphasize the preconscious, and I'm glad you recommend that I should go back to it. And I will. But the fact is, the preconscious is no news to anybody. The idea was really try to identify when, in this particular context of the vote, what would have been one of the drivers, and only one, but a pretty important one, I think, plus all the other nonsense that they were told, of course.
Okay.
And blah, blah, and the role, surprisingly, of the newspaper. The Guardian actually made a point saying that most newspapers, like this printed media, in England had been against staying, that is, they were Brexit voters or supporters, and with the exception of The Independent and The Guardian, and I think another one, maybe The Daily Mirror. Anyway, only three major papers were actually for the Remain and pushed Remain, while everything else was actually pushing Brexit. So he said, but when you think, you know, all right, so, and the comment made by The Guardian is very interesting. See, you know, you would think that television and radio, and particularly television, would have been much more influential in making people make their decision. But in fact, and I don't know where they got the facts from, but they respond, no, the most important influence in this was the actual press, the printed, you know, holding paper in your hand kind of thing. So it's a question. It's a very interesting question to know. And
that brings in the McLuhan level here.
That's right. That's right. That's what I'm saying. Exactly. That's what I'm pushing.
Right. Right. So two thoughts that I had about it. Do you know that the fundamentalist American Protestants, they believe that a united Europe is the Antichrist? Do you remember that? You ever heard of that?
No.
Yeah, it's a very big meme.
I've got to take a deep breath for that.
Yeah, no, listen to this. They believe that Revelation, the book of Revelation shows you that the Holy Roman Empire will be reunited, and the Vatican is part of it, and then some big military leader comes out of Europe, and it's around the 10 kings of Europe, so they see the monarchies coming back, so they're always watching for that. So when the United Europe started in 92 or so, they said, see, Europe's going to get united, and then they're going to have this charismatic leader, and that'll be the Antichrist. So what I find interesting is that McLuhan came in and said, no, no, there's a lot of decentralization going on beyond any of your, what he would call the grand design. The Protestant fundamentalists were falling for the grand design, which McLuhan said wouldn't work anymore. There'd be too much decentralization. So now that the, if this continues and the United Europe falls apart, the fundamentalists are going to have to look around for another Antichrist. So that was one thought that occurred to me about this, that the surety, the certainty that this United Europe was going to be continue to be united and be a problem for Americans and the world. This is where people don't get the newness of McLuhan's point of this hyper multi-consciousness decentralization that's going on that no bureaucracies can keep up with. So that's what's been happening the last 10 years, let's say, especially with Web 2.0, right?
Yeah. So, yes, I think so.
So
I just have serious doubts about the Antichrist.
Okay. Well, being a European Catholic, you don't hear this stuff. You're not familiar with this.
No.
Very strong meme, which was in Reagan. Reagan used to quote it, talk about it.
No way.
Oh, yeah. The moral majority around him, yes, they talked about the Antichrist and the beast.
He was a fool after all.
No, I mean, he was a fool.
Oh, my God.
You're joking. I'm saying he talked, he believed in this. He believed that the Antichrist was coming in Europe.
Well, how can anybody be that naive when the Antichrist is right there within us if we have any of that kind of stuff?
Right. No,
this is ridiculous. I absolutely loathe that discourse, and I don't believe in, I have my problems already with Christ, and I don't need the Antichrist.
Yeah, but the thing is that you don't understand the Americans' hyperkinetic visual space mixture that came from the printing press that it was built on. And the Bible is the sacred book. And when they have an identity crisis, which the decentralized world caused for them the last 30 years, they go back to the book, and they go back to the book, the great book.
True.
I agree. That becomes a core religion. They're fundamentalists of the printing press. That's an American archetype. Whereas the Europeans are not fundamentalists of the printing press. You're fundamentalists of maybe the manuscript or just plain orality. I'm not sure. You do have visual bias, and remember, America added kinetic to it. The Americans are visual kinetic, more kinetic, and that's why the idea that the Europeans were smarter or more literary, more intellectual than the average American, because the Europeans did not have that kinetic dimension that was exaggerated with the industrial phase of America's development. So you got visual kinetic in America, and then you got just pure visuality. But then there's gradations. You've got tactile Germany, tactile Russia. Remember on page 136 of Freeman-Clichet Archetype, he goes through the different modalities. Several of them are tactile. Germany, Spain's proprioceptive, France is acoustic, auditory, and Britain's just blatant visual. And German are tactile. And then you've got the Italian and the southern countries. They're tending toward the tactile with a visual twist. Are you still there?
I am. I'm there physically. Mentally, I'm not sure I'm following because these generalizations sort of hit me. I'd love to see the ground for them.
Well, it's page 136.
Invent one, but I'd like to hear it from McLuhan himself.
Well, he talked about it's in culture or business. He has he takes what he calls plenary awareness, and every culture has a phrase that indicates mastery over the situation.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, and that's on page 136 of Clichéd Archetype, and that's what I'm quoting. And he gives the phrase, and then he gives the sensory bias of each. And
yes,
so,
I remember how he also uses how the sound of dogs was represented.
That was on the same page, yeah, woof, woof, and beep, beep, yeah.
Where the Japanese
dogs
go, pee-wee,
wow, wow. Yeah, that's on the same page. You remember the page.
Yeah, these are great observations.
But you're saying you want more proof about that?
Grain of salt.
Saying you want more proof about that.
I want to know. I would rather want to see it. I'd like to see a connection between their use of language. I mean, that's what would be interesting for sure. If not just the metaphors like bender and grinder, do you remember the
NLP? They're the neurolinguistics. But the thing, remember the French, the Spanish say, I know it as if I'd given birth to it. So that
yes,
shows
I know.
You know that stuff. Well, what do you want, more word? You want more word?
No, give me a couple more. But what I'm saying is that it's the language is there, but more work. I mean, there's a more serious approach to metaphors and their values by I forgot the guy's started writing in the 70s. Kennedy? No, not Kennedy. Anybody.
George? That guy writes about metaphor. He's well known for it.
Yes,
George,
that's
somebody.
Right. Well, that there was that. And then there was Bandler and Grinder. But no systematic study has been made that would be satisfying from the point of view of precisely knowing the culture better between the language and behavior.
Mm.
And, you know, we're back to the Sapir-Whorf versus
behaviorist.
Maybe. Well, no, the whole idea, you know, does our language condition our behavior, or is our behavior superior? I mean, you know, that transcends our linguistic boundaries.
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting question.
Would that be Chomsky versus Sapir and Whorf?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so the second thing is that when we had the move in the 90s for United America, North America, free trade, and then there was rumors Mexico would get in on it. Then you had United Europe. You had these sort of retrievals of big visual space, continental visual space attempts to be what McLuhan called American unity. So you had many parts of the world were trying to unify. And
yes, but you know what runs against that? And I think that Barber explains it very well, Benjamin Barber.
Yes.
What runs against that is the corruption of the very institution that are actually centralizing control of all these big domains. And transparency comes against that and is suddenly saying, wait a minute, yes, you made all kinds of promises you haven't kept, and instead you've taken advantage of us, so we're moving out. That's what's happening. So what it is either that people very quickly show an entirely different way of dealing with the whole situation, and that's why everybody's talking about rebuilding Europe after the Brexit. And I think they're bloody right, and they should go fast on it instead of just go blah, blah, which they do all the time.
Mm.
What's happening is that transparency is going to get the better of all of these people and accelerate retribalization, because people are going to say, for their identity, also for the protection of their resources and whatever it is that their motivation can be, they will actually band together against a centralized control. We can't trust our banks, we can't trust our doctors, we can't trust our medicines, we can't trust our teachers, we can't trust anybody right now.
Any professionals.
Okay?
Yeah, any middle class.
The whole professional world is absolutely, you know,
dehumanized.
Dehumanized and has to be deconstructed and rebuilt in ways that actually show how serviceable they can be. But without that's why I think social responsibility of business today is a trend that is growing. It's a bit like, you know, Loblaws turning all clean clean products and sort of environmentally friendly, the green revolution of like 30 years or 25 years ago.
Yes.
It's a bit the same. But it is going to actually have an effect, and there will be possibilities of actually controlling institutions and big business. Right now, for example, there's a very interesting case in France where between the era of 2009 and 2013, there was a decision by the supreme body of France Telecom, that they would actually license 22,000 people. That's a huge number of people in order to serve their interests. And how would they do it? They would discourage them from actually wanting to continue. Instead of simply saying, well, we'll find you another job, they would do purposely this thing. And now 60 people committed suicide.
Wait, stop. I didn't get this. What license? You start off saying licensing. License what?
Licensing, no. Well, licencier in French means, you know, fire. Fire people, you know?
Oh, licensing means the fire. Oh, okay.
Yeah, fire.
So they were going to fire 22,000 people.
22,000 people, which is on a total, which was more like than something like 30% of their whole. I can't remember the exact. The numbers don't count. They licensed a huge number of people. And the way to do this, it was recorded on the conversation that the head of France Telecom had with one of his assistants, saying, "We'll get them out, whether it's via through the window or through the door."
Wow.
And from that point on, there was, I think, a statement he made in 2009, there was a systematic, strangely French in my opinion, systematic practices of discouragement, for example, moving people very far from their residence so that they'd have to spend hours just commuting while they were actually had bought their residence in order to be close to the job.
Right.
Forcing people to work overtime without paying them, but with kind of specious arguments. methods of bullying, absolute bullying, that have now been proven, and seven or eight of the top brass of France Télécom from that period and present, in fact, because things have continued, have been arraigned. So that's very good news.
Right.
That makes sense. For me, that's the revenge of transparency, and we will have more of these.
Right. So what does Baudrillard mean with the title, The Transparency of Evil?
Well, that's what it is, probably. It is the fact is you see evil at work, and eventually you gather enough strength to fight it.
So Baudrillard did a whole book on that 20 years ago, The Transparency of Evil. It's a good book. So that's what you're saying. We're going to see more transparency, and then there's going to be arguments over what is the negative.
If we have the nerve, we being the people may have to gather enough mental wherewithal and strength of character to actually go. The problem is, we discussed this before in another session, the problem is that, and this goes even for Brexit, it's the profiteers are the ones who run the show because they gather enough people who are interested in their show, whereas the people who have been victim of that show actually don't have enough guts to actually go and fight it. So you know, there are several sites now that are online, and this is where, again, transparency really, really comes through. A site like Avaaz, A-V-A-A-Z.
Yeah.
Or a site like... it'll come back. Sorry about that. I'm being jet-lagged. But the fact is that these sites enable us to be made aware of things that are going on with proof, with signatures, with people in great numbers saying, no, we don't like this, we don't want this. And every now and then, Avaaz is winning. Right now, I think they, thanks to their... It's a bit like... Amnesty International, but online, and online about business instead of simply political kind of mismanagement.
Right.
It's very interesting. So what I'm saying, transparency is taking these various routes and motivating people to participate, at least by a vote or by a decision or by a signature, they participate. Now the question is, to what extent can we henceforth avoid nominating at the head of our countries Donald Trump and co., and start really getting, accountable leaders in business, in government, in local government. It's going to take a while, but
okay.
The battle has started.
Let me respond. McClune wrote about pilots in Vietnam and that they're so far removed from chemical body reality that they had no problem, napalming and bombing all over the place. Is the super angel being everywhere at once, it happens to the middle-class person who grew up in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and then is given a super angelic ivory tower position like this management that says, oh, we'll just get rid of 20,000 people. What do you think of that disservice of the super angelic effect, that someone thinks that they're in charge and they're not subject to being harassed by other super angels? See, the literate person thinks that they're not affected by the environment, but they enjoy the inflated situation they get as a super angel, and then he can wipe out whole environments.
That's Enola Gray, eh?
Yes, yeah.
Remember Enola Gray?
Well, Fires on Theater
Bombing is bombing Hiroshima. The guy doesn't see anything. He just says, I'm doing my job, drops the bomb, then eventually has a miserable life thereafter. But the fact is, that's the effect of being distant from the consequences. And one of the aspects of transparency is that not only we are transparent to the CIA and the government and whatever it is via our digital unconscious, but that the world is transparent. I mean, everything that happens now comes on my, my smartphone via Le Monde or via the Globe and Mail or via The Guardian, yeah, whatever paper I want to read. And it's every second, every minute, somebody gets hit somewhere in... we never heard about anybody being raped in Brazil or in India, the number of times this must have happened. Now we know that a girl has been raped by a whole gang in India. Well, that was 2 years ago. But I'm saying we know everything all the time. So that's transparency.
Okay,
and that transparency creates a new situation. We are globalized by what we are learning every day.
Okay, listen, let's go back to the Enola Gay. Do you remember it got changed to Enola McClune by Fireside Theater?
No.
I think I've told you this before, but you've forgotten. You know,
it was an appropriate change.
This is what they'd said. And they made this in the late 60s, early 70s, one of their albums. They must have read the Playboy interview where McLuhan's talking about, well, we'll have less radio in Venezuela and more newspapers in Russia. You know, this media management on a global level. So they had the Enola McLuhan flying over someplace. Okay, let's bomb them. And they dump a whole bunch of books on Mexico. That was their translation
right.
of the
you know,
Playboy
by the way,
scenario.
Just on a sidebar, Enola is not given to any kid anymore, ever.
What do you mean?
You know what? It's a pretty name, Enola. I'd love to call it.
Oh, that was a name?
I would have loved to call a daughter of mine Enola.
Okay.
It's just adorable. But I have never had a student call Enola.
Okay. So now, that's hardware.
That's irrelevant.
Yeah, that's really irrelevant. Now, just to be transparent here, now, that's another point about what about confessional transparency between people at work? You know, we could have a balance here where people do not talk about themselves as much as they used to because they want the collective transparency to dominate. And McLuhan talked about in the 60s that everybody wore the right political correct or economic correct or war correct or spiritual correct factor on their sleeve while privately they weren't following morals anymore. All right? So there's that hypocrisy. We are the president has to have a certain position about abortion or something, but we don't care what he does morally privately in the old sense, and we don't care what we do privately. So what would be the balance in this new global hyper-transparency? What are people doing to balance that off to create a private, private buffer? What are they
doing?
Well,
I wonder if we can have that because, okay, the whole thing depends on whether big data fulfills its drives and promises or not. If big data is simply another hoax from an industry in the search of a metaphor, which it could be, then what we have is basically a couple of analytics prowesses that are done by this and that business or that government. We do a smart city if we can help it. There's a whole lot of things that we can do with big data, but the real purpose of big data is to do a straitjacket, but more than a straitjacket that would penetrate your body. You know, McLuhan talked about the media being a straitjacket. Here's the extension of that particular concept in that, you know, big data could actually penetrate everything. At which point, then a self-organizing principle, which is always at work, we have seen the internet rise from it, a self-organizing principle would put together all the information about each one of us in each context. We would never have to do confessions again. We would be in permanent confession. And in permanent redressment, automated redressment, like the Chinese philosophy of old, when the Chinese said, you know, society is more important than the individual, for sure, and every individual must conform to the needs and the functions of the social scene. That's what will happen.
I'm just getting an idea that Trumpism, Brexitism, is people going back to the local tribe, racial tribalism, to protect themselves from the transparency. This could be a flip of what you're saying is coming, this transparency.
It could very well be. Besides, one of the masters of opacity is Donald Trump.
Yes.
He hides everything that actually really reveals something about him, particularly
all
the story around his university.
He hides his opinions.
He probably does have them, in fact. He's no fool, but he does hide them. Of course he does. Behind a flurry of repetitions and incomplete sentences and cliches that people already know all about. I mean, he's got his method, all right.
Okay, so I haven't been following the news too much, but I went on there today, and he met with 200 members of Congress, and he met with potentially his vice president, Newt Gingrich. Have you been following what's happened to Trump?
Yes. Newt Gingrich?
Yep, that's who.
No.
He rehearsed. He went to a public gathering.
Did I tell you that I danced with Newt Gingrich?
Beg your pardon?
Did I tell you that I actually danced
with
Newt
with
Gingrich?
How'd you do that?
At the World Economic Forum, it was a dance evening. Of course, I never danced with him particularly, but he was on the same floor dancing along with me.
Ah,
he was one of the speakers at the World Economic Forum. and we dance on the same floor.
Wow.
I mean,
that's Davos.
I mean, at the World Economic Forum, you meet amazing people.
Right. Now, that's an interesting point, that you've gone to Davos with a so-called elitar. Did you find that, I imagine you took a McLuhan view, did you find that they were shocked by it, or they understand it? How did you, how did people react?
What, the dancing?
Beg your pardon? No,
the
no,
dancing?
No. When you spoke there at Davos, that's what you're talking about, right? How did they react to it?
No, well, I got, within 3 years I was fired. I was fired. I was fired because I dared to disagree with the effect of the internet. One of the organizers, and I don't think he was the one who had named me, but he was Belgian and jealous of me, actually had talked about the centralizing effect of the internet on markets.
Yeah.
And I said, no, hold it. And I said it in front during the seminar. I said, well, I mean, instead of that, I see a decentralizing, a kind of a centrifugal effect, because it distributes the markets everywhere. And this was just as valid a reason as the idea that the internet would actually bring all the suppliers and all the distributors and everybody into one single control. That's what he had in mind. But that was only one aspect of the situation. I got fired. I was never allowed again into the World Economic Forum. I'm still what you call that.
A black sheep.
Huh? No, well.
You're banned.
No, yeah, I'm bad.
Well, that's ridiculous. This is a seminar where you're supposed to hear different points of view, and you said something that was beyond
the totally different. But it was not even an attack. But I don't know. Anyway, he never forgave me, and that was that. So,
You say you're fired, were you had a role there, a job?
No. It was like I was invited systematically every year.
Ah, and then never again. Okay, so back to so you have this. So Trump meets with Gingrich, and Gingrich showed himself at the rally today to be, he'd be a good attack dog. He went after the Clintons and everybody. So he was auditioning to be Veep. And I was wondering what you thought of, what's your image of Trump the past week or two? Are you aware?
I haven't been hugely interested in.
Yeah, me either. So we don't have an opinion on that. We've lost touch with the rhythm.
The fact is that he continues to play a dangerous game, which is to attack not only Hillary but also his own party, and he obfuscates them. I forgot the last one I saw was that Star of David that he used to castigate Hillary Clinton, saying she's the most corrupt woman in the history of American feminism or whatever. And he had the Star of David with either her face or that statement, in the middle of it. And then people say, why do we have the Star of David there? I mean, couldn't you put something else? I mean, does that mean you're anti-Semitism as well? And you'd like to, So there was a fair bit of anger, huge anger, around that, but not only from the Democrats or just the ordinary people in the United States, and anybody would have to be angry about that, but particularly the members of his own party.
All
so he's antagonizing enough Republicans to tip the balance, even if the balance already
to tip
was
the balance
not in
to
favor.
What? To tip the balance to what?
Tip the balance to Hillary.
Oh, okay. So
and remember, Hillary now has gotten over the whole issue of her private email.
Yes.
And with that goes also the issue of the meeting of her husband with the Minister
Loretta
of Justice.
Lynch.
So she's now has clear sailing in front of her. All she needs to do is when you have
the
lead in
the
Euro.
It's always going to be polarized. The Republicans now are righteously outraged at the FBI guy who let Hillary off. And it's even worse now. They say she is a criminal. They keep maintaining their position regardless of what happens.
Which is not the most intelligent strategy to follow, I think.
Oh,
but
wait
anyway.
A minute. Now, this is where this resentment to transparency, resentment to everything that's going on is the audience for Trumpism. And the British did that. So you got your preconscious or whatever that term was for people riding on instinct and voting on it before they even know they have to make a decision.
Yeah, no, you're right. But I think that a lot of – okay, this is where the weakness of that theory is. is that there are a lot of other drives that may come and contradict some fundamental ones, and particularly news will do that. News will actually be reinterpreting and resorting out all your unconscious drives,
mm-hmm.
and eventually what will come out then is a decision that would not have been the same before that news. I have no doubt that right now the attitude that has been, or the strategy that has been adopted by Trump is not a very sound one for the, he now ought to navigate between a Democrat and a Republican vision.
Yeah.
He ought to actually introduce some things, count down on the more, you know, I think he'd have to play his card very, very well now to regain the confidence of the American people. He has a ground. He has no doubt about that. He's got probably 30-35% of the American general American vote in his pocket for the moment.
I think that she has
60%.
I get a feeling that the more psychopathic he acts, it helps him.
Helps him with those 35%. It doesn't help him with the majority of American people. I don't see the American people going nuts like a crowd in
majority. Most Americans aren't voting, aren't involved. It's only targeted to, say, one-third of the American population. The elections are always a small number of the total population.
So I don't think
there's a majority involved.
It depends. There has been, I forgot, when we lost Gore to Bush.
Yeah, in 2000.
In 2000, of the voting population, because the whole system is translated via the electorate, but of the whole population, the majority was for Gore.
Yeah.
It was like 51.50 or something,
yeah.
or even 53 point over 47.
Right.
But the electoral body, the electoral college actually made the difference. And so, you know, maybe the vote should be... The popular vote should be considered. That's the proportion,
right.
And maybe past a certain margin of differences, a re-election should be taking place because it's not fair to call yourself a representative of a people when you don't have a genuine majority, simply because some kind of administration trick has allowed you to be there. So I mean, I've always found that a little bit bizarre that Gore didn't win the elections.
Right. What about in, don't you have in Denmark, you have to vote? It's illegal not to vote. Have you heard of that in some of your countries?
I've heard that some countries do it. I didn't know that it was Denmark. But I think it's a fair assumption that that's something that should be required. I mean, we do all have our citizen duty.
Yeah.
And I believe in that. I really do. If you're going to have a real democracy, then everybody has to participate in it at least once every 4 years.
Well, I like when we use McLuhan to show how confused everything is, and that these old ideas about having democracy, and we talked about this several many sessions ago, that we're not in a democracy. We're not going to have a democracy.
No, we know that, but we're pretending.
Yes, we're pretending.
No, but if you, in order to continue to pretend, you have to still talk about it and still see how it would work if it did work. We know it doesn't work, but
okay,
the point
well,
is...
Okay, that's where transparency will ruin those old bureaucracies' image.
I'm glad it will.
Well, then what would you bring in instead, then?
Well, I would certainly, first of all, require accountability from all my representatives in business or in government. I would make it a, I mean, if I'm going to be obliged to vote, I will vote. But and I want the people I vote for to be accountable, whether they're of my party, whether of the ruling party, whether the opposition, whatever it is, people have to actually be accountable. Right now, there's a trend towards that about funding, electoral funding contributions. There's a bit of that. It's not going very well,
okay.
Nor very fast. A lot of people get away with murder, but the fact is there is some investigation going in that direction.
Okay, so McLuhan said in the 70s that he didn't know a politician who didn't have a conflict of interest because they're not operating just in national structures. They're international. They go all over the world for whatever purposes economic bonds are trying to make. So I think that the making everybody accountable can't be done. In other words, that's why the FBI had to let off Hillary, because there's a lot of stuff Hillary has on them, or the contradictions of structural setup, the national structure doesn't work anymore, and everybody's actually working on a global theater level. And
oh, hold it. Let's hear about your approach to this. You think that Hillary actually is criminal by using what did she do?
I don't think one can decide. I think that it's so complicated and conflicted on everybody's part. Like she just tell, and they show this in the House of Cards and the TV shows all the time now, right? They show the compromise of everybody.
Of course. But of course. And what you just said is interesting in a kind of a conspirational theory that she actually exchanged favors with discussion with the FBI as opposed, because she knew things that they didn't want to people to know. Okay, that's a possibility. But then my question then, forget that and just ask myself the question, what was in her, using her private mail, that was criminal? What criminal activities did she, you know, engage in using her private mail? I have no idea. I haven't understood that.
Well, you see people say that it was sloppy. People could, China or something could hack it. They talk about security was really breached, really a problem. But I don't technically look into it. I don't pay attention to the news, Derek.
No, but I do, and I must say that I'm not sufficiently good attention because I can't remember. I know that there was even a suggestion that because of her negligence and the breach of her mail, but I don't think that that's enough to really get her on the hook.
But see, you're looking for facts. There's different
Yes, I know they are. But I think all I read was suppositions that her involvement, I think, with trade-off in Benghazi or vaguely in Libya. Yeah. She had something to do with Libya.
It doesn't matter. You're being too informed.
That's my problem.
Look, you got all kinds of people with strange sociological memes that they grew up with or developed, and they're all conflicting with each other. And there are people who are very adamant about this and that you know, Bill and Hillary killed people and all that stuff, and they got all kinds of evidence for that. And then there's the other people who say, that's silly, not true. You have this conflicting of memes, and nobody's ever going to get to a common on the same page about what did happen. That's why I say we're in a
By the way, you know where really socially and globally transparency begins? It's not WikiLeaks. It's Watergate.
Let me see.
Watergate way before WikiLeaks. Watergate is the beginning of transparency via electronic media, which, of course, are the tapes of what's-his-face?
Nixon.
Richard Mulhouse. I love it because Mulhouse is actually a city in France. Anyway, Richard M. Nixon. But, that was the first moment of transparency. I mean, certainly not the first evidence of a transparent event, but it was the first one that actually went right through the government, forced,
So then what did McLuhan say was reaction to that? It became theater.
Yeah.
Which is not necessarily transparency. That's where everybody has to retrieve a role or an identity and then act out and pretend.
Yeah, I know, but then you get Panama Papers. And What?
Daniel, whatever his name was. The Pentagon Papers, not the Panama.
The Pentagon Papers, right? The Watergate scandal. The Pentagon Papers, which actually led not to papers but to capes, remember?
Yes.
And what was deleted and, you know, all the things. It was great fun those days.
But do you remember what McLuhan said what Watergate was? And this is the level we have to look at this. It's a battle for the advertising dollar between television and newspapers.
Yeah. Know what? That's not his brightest thought. It's great, but it's not his brightest thought.
No, he's showing the dynamics. The media.
No, but I mean, but you can apply that to every move. Remember this, I don't know, this wonderful film, Spotlight. Did you see Spotlight?
Oh, yeah, I did. The Catholic Church in Boston.
That's right. Well, there is a case which would be responding exactly to, you know, this is a magazine, this is a newspaper that's competing with the Boston Globe and with other, forgot which other paper.
Yes.
And it's getting nowhere. And it's a real story. Yeah, Watergate and or Pentagon Papers and Spotlight, même combat. I agree. But again, I don't see that as a unique or a sudden, spontaneous move on the part of a newspaper in order to compete with television or with another paper.
Okay,
I see it simply as doing its job.
Let's apply this to Trumpism. They say that TV gives a lot of time to Trump. They were saying this a few months ago, so that they get higher advertising profits because everybody's fascinated by
Trump. Trump is more fun. Trump is good TV.
So let's put this in media terms. Like if Watergate was TV versus the newspaper, and the newspaper was forced to become an underground rag for the advertising dollar. So today, what is Trump? Is Trump the TV body? No, because he uses his tweeting. So he's quadriphenic. He uses all the bodies. Oh, by the way, that article you sent me about discovering the energies between people, the invisible energies, that would be the astro body. Traditionally, that's astro body.
Okay, yeah, no, okay, good. I had asked the question because it was a genuine question.
Yeah, and then the chip body enhances that, is an extension of the astro body, whereas television is an extension of the physical body. That's a distinction I've made. So you've got Trump being quadriphenic using all the media. Who is the opposition to that? What is the opposition to that? Is it the banking? Remember McLuhan said that visual space, the printing presses, sat on the sidelines in the 20th century while all the newer media engage in civil war. And the printing press or the bankers sit on the sidelines. So that's where you get the conspiracy meme. These guys aren't in the game. They somehow are manipulating. But they don't manipulate. They're off the grid because visual space can't participate. So it's a misperception of the role of visual space. It's not in charge. It just looks like it's in charge by default, and it's not in charge. Since information is the currency and the endless processing of news and information is the economy, so let's say we've come to a new point where it's flipped so that the triggermen on the sideline, the bankers, are now the enemy. So it's a battle between the bankers and the quadriphenic citizen using all the bodies over a non-existent advertising dollar because there's no money anymore. Mm-hmm. This is just a global bankruptcy. Did you hear today that Japan, I think, bought debt all over the place and flooded the world with trillions of dollars to support Brexit? I mean, to support the European Union? Did you hear about that?
No. That's news.
What
exactly happened? Tell me.
Well, that's all I know because someone was telling me about it and I didn't read about it. But it's basically they flooded the world with huge bucks to support the European Union, which is dying now and in trouble, supposedly. So now, remember Jacques
Boxes Lewis? Of support? What are you talking about, boxes of support? Food?
No. Money. They just gave everybody money by buying debt.
Come on. I'm getting on Le Monde right now. This is so crazy that I...
Yeah, I'm trying to point out the craziness that's going on because I didn't read about it, I just was told this. But here's the idea, is the... Jackie Lowell said that the propaganda is not in the content or ideological messages, it's in the environment itself. The media itself, and using it daily, conditions you to a certain way of life. That's what propaganda is, right? You know, that's Lowell's idea.
Mm-hmm.
Well, since money itself is not a viable medium anymore, even banking, like you just said, we don't trust banking, even banking isn't viable, then Japan just prints money to make the idea that there is money. See, this is it. It's propagandistic. Keep the money medium going, like HARP was, or TARP, you know, put several hundred billion dollars into the economy so that the one percenters can't fail. We're looking at an attempt to keep money alive as a medium by Japan, and they're not following any of the debt accounting rules. They're just printing huge amounts of so-called money and spreading around. We have a battle of different old media. And so since people recognize in the transparency that nobody's in charge and nothing is valid, they are retreating into tribalism, just like the socialist parties did at the beginning of World War I. Remember, they were all in international solidarity, and then when the war broke out, which would be a result of the airplane, the automobile, and maybe a bit of the radio world, everybody retribalized. All the socialists, the international socialists, ran back to their particular countries, and then now we're fighting each other. Do you know that story?
No, not at all.
Yeah, what destroyed the communist movement in 1914 was everybody thought they were the working class. But all of a sudden, Germany and different leaders of the different socialist and communist parties said, no, we're not going to work together. We're going to go back and support the Kaiser and become tribal again. Maybe this is what we're witnessing here. And, you know, the biblical scenario of a nuclear war breaking out,
It didn't seem like likely over the last 30 years that would happen. But with this global panic caused by Brexit, and I guess media inflating it, and this huge identity crisis where people are Trumpistically retreating to their tribal zones, that can create a dangerous war situation.
Of course it can. No, it can. You know, I think that we are still in a period of overreaction. Whether we look at the British economy and its future, or we look at the European Constitution, I don't see it falling apart. Neither will. But the point is, obviously, a lot of mending will have to be done over a longer period.
Again, what you just said. Again, insight here. Huh? Overreaction since Telegraph and Kierkegaard, the age of anxiety. Overreaction is constant 24/7. It just shifts what the problem is. You know how they say capitalism is in crisis, been in crisis for 40 years, late capitalism. It just occurred to me that the huge identity crisis caused by global extreme transparency makes everybody reactionary. What was the phrase you just said? Overreaction. I think overreaction is the ground now.
Yes. No, it is, of course. But it's not going to last forever. I have a feeling that things are going to taper down. Apparently,
Why would they taper down?
Because, first of all, in England, one of two women...
I'm not talking about particular issues. The general condition of extending your central nervous system is global panic constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And it just changes. In other words, there'll be another problem next week, somewhere else. But the common factor is that the majority of humans will be emotionally distraught by it, but they don't know that once you have the electronic transparent situation, because transparency began with TV, right? You know, in the 50s.
Well, anything electric. Even the telegraph was already transparent.
Right, because you can hear the rhythms.
Yeah.
On radio. Okay, so you have endless overreaction, which is McLuhan's main point. He said, we won't survive under this electric anxiety and incredible panic all the time. We got to turn it off, or else we're not going to survive it. Well, he's kind of been proven right that we are in constant overreaction, and a real media ecologist will not engage, will not remain informed. That's how you do personal media calls. You do not listen to what everybody's panicking about because, you know, the ground is constant overreaction.
Mm-hmm.
That's what a media ecology understands. That's the new yoga.
That's a point. I mean, it's an interesting one, and I agree.
You've been being drawn in.
But at the same time, you admitted
months ago that you're watching the news. You never were that concerned. Something is drawing you into it. You're forgetting your media ecology stance.
Well, no. First of all, I've never pretended to be a card bearer of media ecology.
Card bearer.
No, absolutely not. Secondly, I actually have a genuine involvement drive that pushes me to watch the news all the time. There is something about the enlargement of your own contemporariness that the news gives you, especially when you have them on command.
Yeah.
And now we have them on command. We don't have to get out of bed to catch the newspaper. We don't have to turn the TV off. We basically play with our smartphone the moment we wake up to find out what's going on today. Like today,
right.
I found out that there was yet another horrible number of people killed in Bangladesh, and read about that and read about. No, the point is, but that is what I was saying before. It's not enough to be transparent. The world has to be, and the world is now becoming more transparent, even though everybody's trying to hide.
That's a good point there. That's everybody's trying to be a super angel and float
yes,
above
I know.
Everything.
But so my involvement with my own presence in this space, which is physically a perfectly agreeable space where I am right now, has to go beyond those limitations and actually get me global. I want to be global. I like being global.
Wow.
So my media ecology is to actually look into the problem at a global level, figure out that that some of it can be mended, and that eventually we're in not a very different situation than Europe was during the Renaissance. That is all kinds of schism. I've always compared the war between the Catholics and the Protestants to the war between the Sunni and the Shia, because even today I was reading that, in fact, while all of these things are happening in Bangladesh and not anymore in Europe and in places like, you know, Baghdad, and that, because the foundation, and I said so in the articles I wrote, the foundation is not us. The foundation is a schism between two sister religions.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing. So we're having the same kind of problem, and that's part of the anxiety and the over... Well, I don't think there's a whole lot of overreaction when things happen in Bangladesh. In fact, there's underreaction there. But the fact is, we are in a state of permanent anxiety, yes, because of jihad, yes, because of the economy, yes, because of Brexit. But overall, we are going through a phase of transformation which is faster and perhaps not even entirely as cruel, but it is global, than the Renaissance wars and the war of 200 years. It remains to be seen when, how can we actually taper it down. But it will. It did taper down after the Inquisition was over, and after, it took a long time, but eventually, we became what we were. And now we're becoming something else, and it's going to take a lot.
Okay, so we have people, most people are turned off and numb, and they go around with whatever attitude, right? They say whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's standard nervous system reaction.
Yeah, they've numbed, and they're not really interested in being informed. But then suddenly also something happens, and then they get all emotional, all the emotion that they weren't dispersing every day, all of a sudden it just dumped out. So they react to the British vote, and they just emotionally say, no, I don't want to be part of that. They just get this notion, I don't want to be part of it, and then they destroy the old economic structure there. So this numbness, what is the the enemy is the information environment, Wolf Blitzer, the CNN, Peter Mansbridge, these guys who keep trying to tell us stuff. You see, you're forgetting, by being more involved in what's happening in Bangladesh, that you're forgetting that is the evil. Is the evil is people providing informational content, because people are indifferent to everything. They've been indifferent in different ways since the incident in Understanding Media, where nobody would help the person in New York City. And McLuhan used to quote
Yes,
that.
I remember that, yes.
Yeah. So it's been exaggerated and squared and quadrupled since then, and it's the silent majority under Nixon's era, and it's now the silent billions, and it's the information factor itself. And this is literally what McLuhan said. When he met Mike Wallace, and I have this interview, Mike Wallace interviewed him.
Yes.
And this is before 60 Minutes, it's 1966. And Mike Wall says, I don't understand what you're doing. What are you investigating? And he says, I'm investigating you. So McLuhan said, I'm investigating you.
Yeah.
And Wallace didn't know what to do. And then it goes into some other stuff.
I don't think it was Michael Watson. It was another first name. But
no, Michael Wallace. I have the transcript.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, I thought you were thinking about Watson.
It stands out. It's Michael Wallace. Remember, he was a game show host before he became a 60 Minutes. So
but I didn't see that interview. I don't think I saw that interview.
I got a bunch of stuff from George
Thompson.
Because
I would have quoted that.
Yeah, no, it's really good. No, George Thompson gave me a lot of, me and Nelson, a lot of unpublished stuff and stuff and this and that. And that was really good for our archive. But that's a really great thing that McLuhan, he meets, he could have met Walter Cronkite. Walter said, what are you investigating? I'm investigating you. He was very pointed about it. And that's what I'm saying. I'm investigating these people who think we need to be informed. Now, Baudrillard partly took that view. He said people are too informed. They're over-informed was one of his more practical things.
Yeah, no, and my first meeting with him, personal meeting, was the organization of that conference on McLuhan
in
the year after he died.
December 83.
The one in Venice.
Oh, not the Paris one?
No, Paris one was the second or the third. I think the first one was run by Amilcar Iannucci and me. We were both working on that. And
you didn't make a document from that. I have the 1983 document, so there's no documentation of the Venice one. That's why I don't know.
Yes, there is. It's in Italian, and it's called McLuhan e la trasformazione dell'uomo, and it's published by Bulzoni, Bulzoni.
But not
and
in
all
English.
All the papers are there.
Okay, so what happened?
Some of them are in English, in fact.
Yeah, what's your story? What happened there with Baudrillard? You met
him? Baudrillard did exactly what you just said, which is what he said, that we are overloaded with information, too much information, and the reaction of standard people would be what he called the objective irony.
Yes.
That is, they would just say, yeah, right.
Yeah. The suspension of belief or disbelief, whichever one it is.
Yeah, no, it was he called it objective irony, saying that the public was in very much in great doubt about a great deal of everything that they were being fed.
Yeah, yeah. They can't figure it out.
The irony stance here, of course, is that you don't reveal your sentiments. You simply allude to a situation by making fun of it. Or not saying anything, but actually thinking otherwise.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think that was a very interesting observation. I'm not so sure that it can be
applied
to today,
though. Well, the issue is, Derek, it can't be, you can't be one side or the other. You're in the interval and you're doing both. And then the Android meme squares that process. So there's four aspects, and everybody's wearing those four levels, and they're communicating all four levels constantly, and nobody can put it into a proper accounting book and say black and white, this is the good and that's the bad. Remember McLuhan said, you cannot have ethics or natural law or morals under electric conditions. You can't do it. There's too many contradictory environments you're involved in. Did you know he said that?
I agree with that sentiment exactly. I do. But that doesn't mean that you cannot at least continue to observe. McLuhan did say the media do us all kinds of terrible media fallout, but I don't want to be run over by the juggernaut. That's what he said, so I keep my eyes peeled. And that's pretty well what I'm doing.
Yes, but now it's interesting. He would always, any new story, he'd fit it back into his formula. And he writes in 53 about the strategy of the modern artist is to have a formulaic response to everything. And that's what he did. He developed a formula. He always put it into acoustic and visual, eye, ear, and then tactility is a hidden ground.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his answer to everything. So he wasn't thinking about anything. He would look for the story that would fit his formula.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes, I know, which was sometimes facile.
Yes, it get absurd, but... he was doing media. He wasn't being informed, and he always kept the big picture. So that actually was attractive. The big picture view is useful. Make people see the bigger scenario and not get lost in the details. So he was faithful to that mission, but he wasn't informed. He didn't know about streaking, and he had a nice thing to say about streaking. Or he knew about the obvious.
Oh, that was really important, man.
Yeah. Well, do you know what he said about streaking? Do you remember that?
No, what did he say?
It was great. He said, the streaker is telling us that we're all getting dressed up, but unfortunately we have nowhere to go.
So he really emphasized the running of the streaker and not his ass.
That's right. That's right. and so that's why he was a Pat Paulson. He was always looking to figure out how to make his formula to evoke laughter. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's what he would do. So he had a comedic purpose. And he wasn't a theoretician, he wasn't a percept, even though he said jokes were percepts, not concepts. So, okay, he was a joker.
You see, now that's interesting. Jokes are percepts. It's art is percept, of course. All of it is percept of what? Not of the content,
right?
But of the interval.
Which is always a joke. It's
the
paradox.
Is always a joke.
Yeah, because you have irreconcilable yes-no factors going on, grievance and release, and so therefore... Every concept that he lays out in Cliché Archetype, which you did, you know, he's got a chapter on paradox, on doubleness, on this and that. It's all based, even has a chapter on jokes, but it looks like a separate thing. It's all about the joke process. You know, that in the end, he is a comedian talking about the comedic process.
Well, that's his Manipian stance.
Yes, that's the Manipian stance. But if he was given a chance of responsibility, he would have taken over the United Nations and turned off TV for 6 months. If they let him, he got serious. Right?
Agreed. But you haven't convinced me to not watch my newspaper in the morning.
No, well,
evening,
I think
that
you're in trouble. Why don't you give your... I'm going to be like McLuhan and say there's a real problem here. You got a serious cancer lifestyle.
No, wait a minute.
Why can't you take a week or two and test yourself?
Oh, no, I can do that. I've done it. No, that's not a problem. I've done it. It's, you know what happened to me, and this was a long time ago? I went on to a cruise, not a real cruise. Well, you could call it on a boat, you know, a sailboat with Marnie and a couple of friends and a skipper. And we spent 10 days from St. Lucia, I think, all the way to the
Trinidad and Tobago? I did that.
It was a lovely thing to do.
Yeah.
And... But during that time, there was no reading. And I remember that I was so starved for actually being in touch with letters that in the airplane, on the way back, I read all the manuals.
See, now that's... See, there's
and every rag I could find.
Right.
There was like a thirst for reading.
Yeah, no, it's good that you're aware of that and to sort of look into how hard it would be to do the yoga of not falling for the, quote, I don't want to call it addiction.
Yeah, meditation actually is a good antidote to all of that. And, of course, I practice that. So
what is it?
Meditation, standard meditation, not religious one, simply physical, mental.
You mean withdrawing? You withdraw?
It's a form, yeah, but you only do that, you know, occasionally, and you sort of reach another level of yourself and of the world, and it's very valuable.
Okay, so we can't say what we are because we're going to do all of it during the day. You're going to read a lot. You're going to listen to a lot. You're going to do meditation. You're going to work. You're going to be creative. You're going to shut down. You actually can't be one thing anymore. You can't specialize in a solution. That's what I'm getting from this.
No, then you'd have to be an hermit.
Yeah, you have to kill yourself, basically, or just completely remove yourself.
Well, no, I mean, being an hermit, I'm not ready for that.
Well, you know, I can go days.
You are an hermit, in fact. I'm not.
No, but here, I'm not totally a hermit because I'm on the phone doing these things and talking to people, and I have an 18-hour radio show, so I'm always talking to people. But I can, because I don't have a job and don't have to go somewhere in an office situation, I can go for 3 or 4 days and never speak to anybody and not answer the phone. So I can do a bit of the hermit thing more than most people can. But then I have access to all kinds of media, and I jump back in, and I'm a what do you call it, a social parasite, a social virus. You know, I'm out there interacting. I'm the opposite of being the hermit. So this is where I get the idea I'm a quadriphenic. I'm exploring all modalities all the time. And most people are. They just don't articulate it.
Actually, I have in store 2 experiences, and I hope to have more, of doing, traveling on foot for 10 days from one place to the other without the help of anything but, the roadmaps and things like that.
And no cell phone.
And no cell phone. The no cell phone has not been practiced because I needed it for orientation.
Oh, okay.
But I tried to stay away from news and from email and from all that stuff.
And what were you starved at the end? Print again?
Starved for my email, for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But during the time, I certainly had a very, very interesting rediscovery of my own body. I mean, you know, when you put your feet and legs to 25 kilometers in a day under different climatic condition, you begin to recognize what you can and what you can't do, and how much it takes. And so you get to know your body very well. And so that was good. That was
and where did you do that?
Experience.
Which country?
I did it in Spain. I mean, I did the Santiago de Compostela trip twice, once with my son, which is a wonderful thing. I recommend it to anybody to do that with a very close person, and really was an amazing experience. And I'm planning to do it to do more. In fact, I have a few partners in mind, including Maria Pia, my other son, who for the moment is too far. He's in Japan, but I'm thinking of doing it with my friends.
Okay, I'm going to switch the topic. What is the greatest? Okay, I'll say it this way. Who was the greatest artist in the role of anti-environment in the 60s for McLuhan?
Warhol?
No.
No, he loved, in Cliché du Archétype, he talks about, what was the guy who made the huge McDonald's at the Art Gallery of Ontario?
I don't know.
He was famous. I mean, all the people were fooling around with consumer products from Andy Warhol to precisely that man.
Oh, you mean
he
Les
would have
Levine?
Loved Adbusters.
You mean Les Levine?
No, wasn't Les Levine.
Who could be someone who did a McDonald's? You mean Oldenburg?
Huge McDonald's made of
Klaus Oldenburg.
Klaus Oldenburg.
Yeah,
yeah. That's name.
Okay, so you're naming anthropomorphic artists. So you know who the greatest artist was? As
no.
an anti-environment, following that Lewis principle, it was Canada.
Oh.
Now,
you see, Canada doesn't follow my definition of the artist.
I know.
But
this is what, in this new book, counterblasting. Very interesting new McLuhan scholars writing about Lewis and McLuhan and Sheila Watson. But one of them, a guy named George Betts, takes literally the quotes by McLuhan from that talk, Canada, the Borderline Case,
mm-hmm.
and he puts together a lot of interesting point to say that Hare Rosenberg or Clement Greenberg, all the arts world, even Wilfred Watson, because when they saw McLuhan talking about the artist being this or that or comprehensive and the one who knew what was going on, they thought he was talking about a human artist. No, he was talking about environments, because media environments were now the new art forms, not wrestling, not hockey, not painting, not sculpture. He lays that out. It's the media.
But you still need a person behind them.
No, wait a minute. No, this is the thing. It's the media environments themselves are the art forms. Then you realize that Canada is a media environment. It's a political meme. It's all that it is. And it's not a person, but it was the only entity in the world that lived right beside the American elephant, knew it intimately, but was also detached from it, involved and detached.
Yeah, agreed. But art form actually is a medium in which to express art. In anything that I read about McLuhan, it was always the art form was the medium available or the means available to anybody who would pay attention to actually turn it into a form of art, so that television becomes an art form under the influence of Internet and becomes YouTube. So that's how I see art form.
Well, but we didn't include nations and cultural environments.
I have never read that anywhere, so I can't remember.
Well, this is what George Betts puts together, these obscure quotes.
This one is from Counterblast. This is one word I would have passed over very quickly.
No, Counterblasting is a new critical collection of essays.
Okay.
Counterblasting Canada.
And
George Betts puts together a bunch of quotes. I'm familiar with all of them, but he made it quite obvious that everybody else thought he was talking about artists as some Andy Warhol guy or something.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't. He was talking about particular environments, media in the world. They were the new changers of perception, as art traditionally was. They're the new teaching machines. But
Brexit is surely an art form. Hey.
Yeah. Okay. Now, maybe we can fit in there. But the point was that the ground, America becoming a world environment, what is the anti-environment to America? It's Canada. And Canada had the sensitivity. So Canada was the greatest artist in the world. Now, it's fantastic to be able to say that. Go over next time you see Michael Snow, or go to the Banna Alley, and they all talk about this art. Start using McLuhan's quote, bizarre.
No, you're right. It's a nice opening for a major conference.
Yeah, because he actually meant that the media environments, which are our collective unconsciouses, were the occupants of the global theater. He even made a play about that, where just the media would be the actors. But it's so perceptive, and he's really talking about himself. He's Canada, and I am the anti-environment to this American thing.
When did that
thing
get published? Is it a recent book? It's
yeah, fun. It just came out. Counterblasting Canada.
Counterblasting Canada. And it's all about Marshall, or is it more things?
No, it's about Wyndham Lewis, Sheila Watson, and Marshall, and Wilfred Watson, and basically the Lewis gang, which is Sheila Watson did her PhD on Lewis, and McLuhan was a devotee of Lewis, and then Wilfred Watson was in the middle of it. And now, remember, you couldn't even remember his name last time we talked, you know, the guy that blew cliche archetype? Well, there's somebody, Paul Teason, you might know him. He does this in-depth article because there's all these letters that Watson wrote and diaries that we haven't seen before, or I haven't seen them. And the drama that Wilfred went through after he was kicked out of the coach house in 69-70, he then went back to Edmonton and started doing his playwriting again, and he felt comfortable doing that, but he couldn't get over the shock of what McLuhan turned into. And when you read these letters, he is emotionally in a, you know, anxiety about McLuhan rejected him, and he's there determined to make a case that McLuhan didn't understand what he understood. So there's even some scholars that say Wilfred was smarter than Marshall, and the other scholars say McLuhan was. But what you really see is that McLuhan had a unique definition of the artist that Wilfred didn't get. Nobody got it. But he talked about the artist. He was talking about a technological environment.
No, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'll just follow that up. So you say it's George Best?
Betts, B-E-T-T-S. He's he's at Brock University, I think. There's several people. Well, I'll just say the names to you. What you might recognize some of them. You don't know Paul Teason?
Does no.
it mean anything to you? Well, you know Leon Surratt.
Yes.
Yeah, he opens up with Remembering McLuhan. And then there's Elena Lamberti, Adam Hammond, Adam Welch, Philip Monk, Dean Irvine, Linda Mora, Christine Smitka, and Darren Welshler. Now, who? I'll give you a clue who they are.
Well, Philip Monk is very well known.
Yeah,
he was the head of the AGO or something like that.
Yeah, I think he's director of the Art Gallery of York University now.
Of York University, yeah.
Yeah, and you have Gregory Betts is the Chancellor's Chair for Research Excellence at Brock University, where he is a director of the Center for Canadian Studies. And Paul Thiessen, Professor Emeritus, English and Film Studies, Wilfrid Laurier University. Linda Mora, full professor, Department of English at Bishop's University. So a lot of Canadians. Darren Welshler is at Concordia. Elena is in Italy. Dean Irvine is at Dalhousie University. Paul Chartison is at the University of Alberta. Adam Hammond is at San Diego State University. So Gregory Betts, B-E-T-T-S, but all the articles so far are really good. It's one of the few books collections on McLuhan that I'm basically might be learning something. And it's just this great idea. Someone finally, I suspected it because I knew, I'm one of the few people who know that media environments are art forms and that he was going to do a Broadway play with the media as actors. So I knew.
Yeah, I know that. Yes.
Yeah,
where
I knew
did
that.
He say that?
In the interview in Hydro, the Hydro company put out a magazine called Forces in 1973.
Yes, yes, I remember Forces. I actually quoted Forces several times about McLuhan and from McLuhan's stuff in there.
Yeah, it's a very good interview, and it also has Herbert Marcuse and a couple other people. But McLuhan says a lot. He talks about working with Carl Capek,
Capek,
yeah.
And, or Chipek or something like
and
that.
And he says that, Capek says, you're a cartoonist. And McLuhan says, that's right, I write cartoons. Now, that's an important thing to realize. He wasn't trying to be anything that people thought he was. He was a bit fucking cartoonist with broad outlines. You know, remember the cartoon is a cool medium with broad outlines. You don't feel it. You don't have a lot of visual detail. Well, when he talks about Canada being an artist, that's a cartoon statement.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so that interview had a lot of interesting things. That's where I got the idea that he said NASA, the broadcast of the moon landing, should have shown the body processes on monitoring the process of the astronauts, not worrying about whether they walked on the ground. It's what's happening to their blood and their headache potential and whatever is going on in the body that they're apparently monitoring. That's how you would watch that event. It would be more dramatic. And then he felt that was what the global role of the Center for Culture and Technology would be. They have this computer thing, and they'd be monitoring the blood life, the media diets of all the countries around the world. That was his vision in Playboy magazine.
Which is
a hugely satirical vision, but he actually, if, now there's the contradiction or healthy paradox, if he was given the opportunity to run, get into position of bureaucratic power to implement a program, he would have turned TV off for 6 months. That's what that's the practical solution, he said. Now, what's interesting, we can't turn the communication world off now. So you can't have media ecology in that sense. Nothing can be ever turned off again. And that's why you get metaphors of the Matrix is taking on a life of its own. The Endor meme is a living beyond humans, and that's the state of overreaction we're in.
We
have been, and Croker develops this in Extremis, we are not in the chemical body as surplus flesh.
We're in panic. Croker has a point. I mean, it's the same point as Baudrillard in some fashion.
And same point as McLuhan.
I've got to get back to my other work. And, I think if you want to go back tomorrow, we can do it again. I mean, but every time, it takes an hour out of my only intelligent moment in my life, which is the morning.
All right. So look, I want you to get your article done. So let's wait a few days, I think.
Okay, that's cool.
All right, but
all right.
I think we come to a great understanding of Brexit, didn't we?
I think up to a point. I don't know if I'm missing anything, but up to a point, yes. And if I have more to say, I'll say it next time.
All right. Okay. Well, great talking to you.
Great. Bye.
Okay, bye.